This is a production of Cornell University.
It's a very powerful certain, but the future of the professor is going to be
this. And the degree accreditation.
You got the accreditation that you can be able to get credit for taking Cornell. So that's what you got. Here's the big issue. It's a very politicized issue.
Thank you, Professor Booker. Anything else for Professor Booker?
I have a question. How do people like to use systems for assigning finalists?
Can you repeat that question?
How do people like to use the system for assigning finalists? Just so you know, I teach a large freshman class, and there are like three or four other large freshman classes, and they all are scheduled to serve two new days on the exam here because the goal was to get large classes in early, and you have to get large classes. So it could be interesting. So we have like people that have three or four classes.
I think that's an issue. The assembly actually passed a resolution about the final exam schedule. We were actually, between myself and Monet, the GPSA chair, we were notified on Wednesday before the schedule was released that we were given three mock-ups and told that was our period for feedback. Unfortunately, the GPSA already had their meeting and could not actually vote on it. So luckily, we were able to at least somewhat choose one of the mock-ups as an assembly of endorsement, which was the second model, the front-loading the large courses first. There were a lot of pros and cons to each one. We were not also pleased about the process in general, and we actually sent along a very familiar memo accompanying our choice about
that. Just so you understand, so freshman students that have the most pressure, who tend to take the large courses, now we have a number of students in our class, so these are three main science classes, mm-hmm. So chemistry, math, and biology exams. Because
large
classes, they got preference,
they're good. Yeah. We did not agree with any of the markups, and there was actually quite a bit of discussion about them, but we took the lesser of three evils and went for the one that was a bit more balanced in terms of the damn direct conflict that had the worst bad in it. So we had the least number of bad in it, according to
this. This is actually, I think, could be an important issue, so I'm going to ask Joe whether or not it's too late. So right now, all the big classes go first for the exam. Just to take the classes.
I agree with you. This is actually wrong. It is what you need to go to the best way. The classes are going to spread out.
But the big classes are clustered in here. So I see 1440, more than half the students take, in my class, take 2080 is within 24 hours. Math is within 24 hours. Half our students take math. So half of them, most of them are in math, chemistry, and biology. Those exams are within 24 hours.
Well, I mean, the other criteria is supposedly coming in here for eliminating contiguous exams, eliminating or minimizing, and you get academic and reduce.
Yeah, that was good out, but I don't know how to get it.
Gentlemen, in the interest of time, I need to move the meeting along. We can pick this up at the end and or perhaps determine whether we should address it at a future meeting. Coming to committee reports, executive committee, the one thing I need to report to members is, as is typical for the University Assembly, at the end of the year, we get busy. The resolutions start coming out of committee. We need to hold a meeting on March 11th, which is traditionally a standing committee date, an optional meeting date for the full assembly. So I am convening a meeting of the full assembly on March 11th in this room, 4:30, 2 weeks from today. We do expect to have Resolution 5, which is our response to free expression, a.k.a. Hope Plaza, for a vote at that meeting, potentially for a vote. So we do need to have a full quorum. That vote, that resolution is out for public comment. Although I would say to members that so far there have been very few comments on that resolution. There does not seem to be any problem with the posting mechanism, so either they're not interested or it's not on their radar. Please talk to your constituents. I've received a comment from the faculty. I've seen a comment from one of the groups that was involved in Hope Plaza. Make sure that this gets your group's attention so that we can dispose of it properly, hopefully, on the 11th. With that, I'm going to postpone the other committee reports to later in the meeting and introduce Chief Zoner to give the annual update of the CUPD and a preview of the CLARE report statistics. Chief Zoner.
Thank you. I'm sorry I dropped my uniform. Okay, so the annual update for
all right, so here we are. The first thing I wanted to address with the group is that the annual security report that you have here reports a very, my Venn diagram here, it's a very small subset of our actual activity level. So incidents reported, reported arrested officers at larger register levels. Incidents reported other law enforcement agencies, authorities where, you know, where we have staff or branch campuses, those types of things, there's kind of what's surrounding here. But the CLARE is very specific about what it wants to hear about and what it wants to hear from and how it wants to hear from it. And those are the crimes that we address in this campus watch. If you want to copy this, there's a hard copy up here. So, you know, for example, the outside departments would be the police department, Geneva, so the Geneva Campus Police Department, Rhythm Call Directors, and athletics that may be on travel or other events. The clarification is because I think a lot of people seem to think that the CLARE statistics is a crime report. It is not a crime report, it's a specific crime report. And it only addresses major violent crimes, motor vehicle theft, weapon and drugs, liquor laws, and then violence related crimes and those same similar crimes. So these are excerpts. If you picked up a copy, this is actually page 8 and 9 inside the campus watch. We are required by law to report 3 years back worth of statistics and to break it down roughly. It is a little confusing. But this is on-campus residential facilities. These numbers will sometimes be the same, but if you have a if you have a residential facility off-campus, then the numbers might be slightly different. There is overlap. So of these 5 reported, 4 happened in only residential facilities. This probably the fifth one was probably in an academic building or in one of those. And then there's non-campus building and property. In theory, defines what non-campus is, and that doesn't mean Cornell doesn't own it. That means it's not in central campus. And then there's the classification totals, and these totals are also very specific. They don't allow for crimes that are reported to us that are found unfounded. So nothing that gets reported gets undone. If it gets reported, it gets a statistic. And then they're broken down by category here. And then the DWI and drug law offense. I don't want to delve too deeply in the numbers other than to say they tend to track fairly steadily across our sexual assaults. We have seen a slight increase in reporting. As we're going through the years, our 2013 statistics, these are calendar years, not academic years. For 2013, are January to December, and those will be out just before students come back. They have to be out by October, but we always try to get them out right before students come back in August. So you should see the new issue will come out at that point in time. So these are the reports that come to us from directly to us, Cornell Police, and then, oops. These are the ones that come directly to us, and then these are the ones that are reported to other campus security authorities. So if people bypass the police but go through the judicial administrator's office, or you go to the resident call director and they say, I don't want to talk to the police, these are generally speaking in addition to anything that comes to us. So those will be added to this across the board. And again, they're very specific in how they collect the data. They don't tell you the adjudication of those cases. These are when the reports come to the police, not when the incident occurs. So the incident could be several years old, but then the police will come to the attention of police or another campus security employee. In both cases, we had, yes.
Chief, in your previous page, hate crimes, none in 2012. It seems to me, and maybe this is 2013, we had some very unfortunate incidents around the fraternity area. Was that not classified as a hate crime, or was that a 2013 statistic?
I can't really answer that question. It was in Is October an aberration, or is this part of the new academic calendar, and people had more time and space and looking forward to the comments into the medical emergency and that kind of thing? And traffic stunts is another thing that everybody hates what we do on campus, but it has a purpose. It has several purposes. I thought I'd highlight it here in my limited time. One is in 2012 through 2013 is 69 DWIs on the campus. 69 DWIs. That's a lot of DWIs. 60 of the 69 were not affiliated. So these are people that just randomly driving through campus. There might be some connection. It's very hard to tell if it's like a spouse or a kid or something along those lines. But generally speaking, we look for any close affiliation and try to denote that. And the remaining nine, one was a faculty staff. I don't tend to differentiate there. And then eight were students. And again, I echo Mary to say that most of those were older students, graduate students versus undergraduates. And I don't have any stats on whether anybody was underage. The traffic offenses. So these are warnings and citations. You can see a lot more warning than we do offer citations. That is not because there's nothing to write for, just to clarify. If you're stopped for a reason and you're the reason cited, just want to clarify that if you don't get a ticket, it's a great lucky day. It's not because they just felt like stopping you. The citations that we're writing are, you know, the two-thirds of the warnings that we go. And then the seizure is sometimes it's not clear the way we document things, whether or not these are a citation or a warning. We're using two different systems to sound that here. But as you can see, as we increase our citation writing, our motor vehicle accidents start to decrease. And so, just to give you again, 2012, 2013, 167 property damage accidents on the campus annually. I know people think there's not that many, that's what, one every other day. So it's pretty frequent when we have the hit and runs, which are sometimes property, generally property hit and runs, when we smash it into something and drive off. And then the personal injury accidents. This is the one we're really animated in increasing. Mm-hmm. This kind of also ends up capturing a lot of the parking garage incidents where somebody lands into somebody while they're parking or something that are less impactful on a person's well-being. But these the NBA animals, those are impactful as well because you often have an injury either to the animal or to the person driving distress. It's also impactful. That just kind of gives you an idea of our activity level of the number of. And some of these offenses are through targeted enforcement. We all seen our releases on doing pedestrian safety enforcement or two red lights or seatbelt enforcement. Those are the citations that are shown to dramatically reduce these types of injuries. And then I keep looking and not being patient. So then do we have some standing resolutions on it? We're floating around the assemblies, the building security committee. We're now reformulating that because my title is now the campus security committee. It has been formed. It is operational. We meet very regularly. We're launching a campaign to do exactly what the resolution asks to make sure that we're keeping tabs on construction guidelines, project manager guidelines, and general construction standards so that we're increasing the overall security of the campus. And I think that's not to be confused with locking down the campus anymore. Cognizant that there are efforts that we could make to make it a safer place for everybody, and that could be environmental design, that could be providing people safe haven if they need to escape from an incident that's going on, those types of things. And the NDSS is the common terminology for network video surveillance systems cameras. We had a resolution asking to increase that in public areas. We have submitted some capital plans again, and in the meantime, if we don't receive funding for that, we're working again through the Building Security Committee to identify kind of low hanging fruit where we already have infrastructure in place. Where can we, what can we leverage? What kind of grants can we get to move some things in for highly populated areas where see some benefit in referring or deterring crime. I put the weekly messages on there. It's been now a year. It has a lot of great feedback. I think that the University of Communications has done a fantastic job in supporting me and getting that messaging out. There's quite a team that put those together. We try to keep it interesting. Certainly, the I think the highest rated one was the no smoking open window one. people seem to enjoy that. But overall, very positive reviews, and people say keep it coming, and we're keeping it interesting. If there are any suggestions that I have, you know, I'm always welcome to suggestions, so please feel free to email me directly. The crime prevention programming and outreach is through the roof. We've really got a wonderful team out there. I'd be surprised if any of you haven't seen one of their programs. And if you haven't, certainly sign up for one. We do a great job. And you get some support from the ships as well as you see a lot of different officers and that respect. They're probably one of the most frequent outreaches aside from my weekly message that provides the connection to the community for these sort of things. The weekly message impetus was actually because of a couple of high-profile sex crimes that were reported on campus, and I know you guys were all aware that the one we were able to ascertain was unfounded. But then there was one that occurred. We keep calling it the Suspension Bridge case. It was actually off of the Suspension Bridge. It was in that general area back in September 12th. All I can say about it is because it's an active investigation, is that it's a very positive investigation. We do have engagement with the district attorney's office. These things move very slowly, especially in this particular case where we have limited information. It was a very isolated crime, and it was very difficult to investigate. But we continue to hope that the district, it's really turned over to the district attorney's office, but we're supporting that investigation. It's still not spinning, just slowly. And then most of you saw the defendant that was arrested, recently indicted, but arrested back in April of 2013, the off-campus case about the rape there. And so we're very happy that we're able to reach kind of some end game here, but you can see how long, I mean, even when you have someone immediately at hand in April of 2013 that you charge immediately, it took a full year to get an indictment on that. So these things take a lot of time, they're a lot of strain on the victims, survivors, and we provide a lot of support from a lot of different offices to try to make sure people still courage support. Questions?
Members? More.
So when you were talking about the false bridge alarms, you said on average about two a day. Does that take a lot of time and resources?
Sure does. What value does one have? You know, if you save one life responding to all those alarms, I think it has a significant value. Now that we're a year into it, we've been able to fine tune some things. That's how we've gotten it down to the 2 to 4. Some of the numbers are a little bit probably skewed because initially there were a lot more false alarms. Mm-hmm. But we've learned when to sort of turn them off and put on regular routine checks, where the officers have to stop and literally walk the area to look for people. Weather is one of those things. High winds will upset patterns. A lot of what we've been getting lately could influence thunderstorms, massive temperature changes, and tremendous blasts. So it absorbs heat very quickly, and the cameras are thermal, so it comes down with a lot of data. Migrating birds and falling snow and leaves and vegetation. So a lot of work by the grounds crew to make sure everybody stays as clean as possible to get our best.
Are you in contact with the vendor or anything on how to improve this at all? Or?
We have been. Those people hate us. We've maximized the available technology. Absolutely maximize it. One of the places where we would like to, that's one of the areas that we're targeting for more network video surveillance systems, because we have on top of the bridge, but we don't have bridge approaches. Those are still choke points. So those are areas that we're hoping to be able to increase that that viewpoint. And again, it's a deterrent, but as well as kind of fact finding at the end of the situation where we have to ask for funds. There isn't anybody, just to be clear, there isn't anybody viewing these cameras all the time. They're just, you know, the personnel for us. They're almost always for that data. When we get a call, someone calls and says, hey, my friend is sitting in front of him, said he's headed for a bridge, we will coordinate. If I have the staff inside my dispatch area, we'll coordinate with cameras up, officers moving. But it is a concerted effort. It's not one that's not monitored.
How many of those cases are false alarms with people? Like, they don't necessarily have the right plans to do something for the
city? We've had a very few numbers of people throwing things intentionally into the mesh. Only one rabble rouser that I can really say that was really intentionally trying to cause problems, and they were a non-affiliate. Didn't like the mesh, didn't like the fences, and so that's how they felt that they should take action. But then for the most part, it's curiosity or someone doesn't secure a load on a car going by or not, they left a fear on top of the car. Those types of things do happen. Default sometimes. And it was interesting because, again, with a thermal camera, that's what triggers the motion of the thermal. So it was a very cold day, and somebody did a small beach ball to give away, I think it was during January. And they've been carrying it, so it retains the body heat of the individual, they've been carrying it. And you can't really tell if they purposely threw it over there or if there was some batting around and it kind of got over there. The beach ball was just blowing or in the mesh, and then all of a sudden it went down to nothing. And once the heat was gone and it got the ambient temperature, you couldn't even see it. It's interesting to play with the technology. It's interesting to see what's available to us. I think it's working as well as it can work at this point. And like I said, I think there's been enough people that we have been able to get into the system for support that I can easily say that we've saved ourselves a lot of money.
Other questions? Thank you, Chief, very much. Ms. Grant, we're at about 7 minutes to President Skorton, if he's on time. Do you want to begin, or do you want me to backfill with some of the smaller items we have and proceed after he comes?
Your call, I can do
this. Well, if you would prefer, then let me introduce Mary Beth Grant, the Cornell Judicial Administrator, and the Associate J.A., Jody Kunk-Chiplicki. Welcome, and thank you.
Well, thanks so much for inviting us to speak to you all. I'm passing around that handout rather than doing a PowerPoint, since we usually charge with the president of something to do a handout. And that also gives me the ability to sit and do this in an informal way. You all have already received electronically a copy of the annual state office report that was actually for 2 years this year. So I am highlighting just three items that I thought would be most important for you all to be aware of, but I'm happy to answer questions about anything that's important in addition to this today. So the first one is that just to show how our numbers, our overall referrals, have looked for the past 10 years. And as you may recall, in the report that I wrote last month, we were guessing a little bit because we were having some trouble with our database and unable to give you corrected data about that. So the cases are staying pretty consistently high. For those of you who have been here a long time, you may remember that in academic year 2001, we had a jump from an average of about 500 cases to about 800 cases. It was the first year of Morris Campus. It was the year that the Twin Towers and John, we weren't really sure if that was an aberration or if that was going to be the new pattern. And it turns out that that was the new pattern. You'll see that in 2006-2007, we had a big jump, both of those years. Those were almost
exclusively caused by referrals for digital copyright referrals, people downloading music and movies. And we've worked with our colleagues in CIT to not refer first and second time cases because it's 25% of our cases, 33% of our cases in 1 year. That's too much. That's not the best use of our resources. We need to be spending, using our resources on different types of things. So then you can see the numbers go down again. Still a high amount, but a more reasonable level compared to those 2 years. So far this year, we have 592 cases. So just doing a best guess, I'm guessing we'll go into the 800 range again this year. It's more than last year where we had a bit of a dip. Okay. So the next thing I want to talk about are our sexual assault referrals. Many of you may remember that we switched gears, and this is our first year that we're using the new policies as what we're calling the 6.4 process, rather than using the policies under the Commission Code of Conduct. And that was actually a two-year changeover period, 1 year of debating what it should be, and then 1 year of using policy 6.4 to incorporate student conduct or misconduct. So I wanted to give you some sense of how that's working. The first thing I want to say is, as you're looking at these numbers, be cautious when you look at numbers reported in a chart like this. These numbers are not going to match other numbers. For example, we look at academic year, July 1 through June 30th. When you look at the query numbers, they're looking at calendar year. These numbers reflect cases that are reported to us, which are sometimes reported to campus police, sometimes not reported to campus police. They reflect cases that are off campus. They reflect cases that we don't even know the names of the parties sometimes. We might get a call from a residence hall director who says, I've been talking to a student. He or she has a friend. I don't know who the friend is who's reporting sexual assault. What should I do? And we get information to those people. We try to, we have the name of an accused person, but we don't have the name of a complainant, or if we have the name of a complainant, we don't have the name of an accused person. We're trying to get information to those people, and we're collecting that as a number of a case that we're aware of. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we've done a full-blown investigation and that there's been, finding of responsibility or not. The second line, the formal complaints, those are the ones where we've done some sort of investigation. Doesn't mean that they're all findings of violation. It means that we've investigated and pursued a more formal complaint. So you can see that the numbers are different. Prior to what's on this chart, the numbers were about 3 referrals a year. So I had the opportunity to check our stats from 1990, which is the first year that we kept electronic data, through 1993, and the average was 2000, so for about a 20-year period. And our average was about 3 a year. 2004, we had a bit of a bump, and then the other 2 years were about 3 a year. So really, since 2008, we've seen an increase. I think 2011, 2012 are directly related. The increases that you're seeing there are directly related to the debates that were going on here. There's a lot of reports in the Sun, so I think we've got some colleagues here again. I think that all of that information was good because it's helping people realize that there are processes and there are things that they can be doing if they are experiencing this type of misconduct. So do you want me to pause now and then let David?
When he comes in, we'll...
I'll pause for dinner. And this year to date, since September, we've had 8 reports of sexual assault and 5 of those have been reported with formal complaints. So what's working well about our new process, the 6.4 process? One thing that we've been very pleased about is that we have volunteers from around campus, primarily out of the student's office, residential programs, human resources, who are serving as assistant investigators. This is not something that was required by policy 6.4, but we identified as a best practice that we would like to have two people reading, working on each investigation. Jody Constablicki, my associate today, who's here today, is one of the people who leads the investigation. The other one is Prince Repeat, who's also an associate today, and we're able to attend today. And we paired Jody and Prince with one of our partners who's been trained that works in a different area. That's been really helpful to have another set of ears and eyes doing these investigations. It's also provided the opportunity for more diversity, particularly in the area of gender diversity. So we tried to match up with Jody's male counterparts and with Clint's female counterparts so that each individual who's being interviewed has at least some identification with one of the investigators. So now should I stop?
Is that a good stopping point? Then I'd ask the presenter to please suspend her remarks for a moment as we turn to Dr. Skorton. Welcome, sir, and thank you for coming again to speak with us.
Thanks for having me here. Can you guys go around one more time, because I lose track of who's who.
Certainly. Please, Dr. Wayne.
I don't lose track of Randy. But
Sarah.
Don't lose track of Sarah either, actually. Connor, what? You're undergrad. Okay,
yes.
Great.
Right.
Melissa. Oh, hi, Melissa. Hi, boss. Yeah.
Stephen.
Hi, boss.
Amy.
Noah. Also
office. Good to see you.
Hi, that's an employee.
David's not graduate student.
Good to see you. So you're here for the GPSA?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
We're all still undergrad.
I know.
I can't even see Tracy.
I'm Alex Moore. I'm a graduate student.
I'm Sophia McGarry.
Me too.
Bill Kevin, Bill McGarry, Kevin as well.
Chris, my team boy.
Good to see you.
Still
hey, Joe.
Ned, what's up?
Yikes. Yikes. Okay. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, as always. I looked at the lineup of some of the things that you'll be considering. I'm very much looking forward to gaining your wisdom about the Hope Plaza incident. I think you're about to discuss that, and I look forward to getting your thoughts on that. If it's acceptable, I thought I might talk a little bit about my view of shared governance. Here's the reason, but I'm going to ask you if this is okay. Most of us are going to also be together at breakfast tomorrow. I think the majority of the people here are also going to be at breakfast tomorrow.
Yes.
And so I know that there's a lot of things that are on your mind. I only know some of them, obviously. One of the things I know is on your mind is the Faculty Senate resolution regarding carbon neutrality. I'm glad that you're here, David. I would like to talk to you a little bit about my view about shared governance, and then I have something I want to share with you about the Faculty Senate resolution, so if you can bear with me, I'd like to do that. Those of you who know me and have worked with me for a while will know that I take the shared governance stuff real, real seriously. Every single resolution you send me, I get advice from outsiders. I never respond just based on my own point of view. I do try to look at every single one. I don't know exactly how many resolutions I get. I was mentioning to you, Liz, this is the last student leaders meeting that I'm going to try to figure out a way to, working with Gina, to sort of summarize what we get, but dozens of resolutions a year in the aggregate from the assemblies, and I spend a lot of time on every one of them. There's two sort of principles or ground rules that I always promised myself when I was president at Iowa and at Cornell about shared governance. One is that I would take things very seriously, and secondly, that I would not be disingenuous and tell people that I was going to consider something if I really was not going to consider it, because it's a waste of your time. So the SA sent me a resolution about divestment last year, and I have very complex feelings about divestment. When I was at the University of Iowa, I championed divestment from South Africa, along with a lot of other people. I know that this campus had a wide campus debate and did not decide to divest from South Africa. first year I was here, I proposed to the Board of Trustees that we divest from Darfur, and they did. They supported that. I struggled a lot with this one. I've gotten a lot of input, not only formally, but also offers informally to meet separately with groups of people on both sides of the issue. My understanding to this minute is that my response to the Faculty Senate resolution has not been broadly shared with the community. What I do with my answers to resolutions that are sent by any shared governance body is send it back to the body who sent it to me because it's their resolution. In this case, Joe Burns, of course, was the conveyor of the resolution and receiver of the response, and Joe decided, I think appropriately, to share it with every member of the Faculty Senate. To my surprise, I haven't heard anything more about it. It hasn't appeared in the Sun, even though it was openly shared with the Senate. And I've been told, and this may or may not be accurate, that a lot of the other bodies here are considering whether to sign on to that or a similar resolution. So I thought I would like to offer to review for you what I wrote back to the Faculty Senate on the off chance that you haven't seen it. Before I do, though, I want to ask you, do you want me to share that? And the reason I'm asking you is I don't want it to be coercive of your discussion. I can also not share with you what I wrote to the Faculty Senate, and you can have a debate, and we can talk about it some other time, tomorrow morning or a month from now or whatever happens. But I'm very comfortable, and Joe has told me that he's fine with me sharing this, to tell you verbally what I wrote back to the Faculty Senate, since my impression is that most of you haven't actually seen the response. I know you have, David, and others. So that's the first thing is, can you give me some feel, some sense of the room, but whether you'd like me to discuss that with you? I'm prepared to do it. I can do it without any papers. I've spent a lot of time on it.
I have not seen the response that you sent to the Faculty Senate. I would be interested to hear your remarks and your thoughts about it in advance. This is a very independent body. If they disagree with you, we'll send you a resolution. If we understand your thought process, I think it's very, very timely to understand your thoughts on it.
Are there people who feel differently than Jim? Because I do not want to be, I don't want to affect your debate. It's your debate. Okay. So the essay resolution asked for a straightforward divestment of investments in fossil fuel companies. The faculty resolution was a bit different. It had two planks. One plank was to accelerate the rate of the campus target to become carbon neutral. When I signed up President's climate commitment, and I was one of the first presidents in the country to do so, we estimated very arbitrarily that it would take us to 2050 to get the campus to carbon neutrality. And the Faculty Senate resolution asked that we accelerate that to 2035, so move the target for carbon neutrality up by 15 years. I thought that was a very worthwhile concept, and since the 2050 was somewhat arbitrary, I endorsed and agreed to sign on to that. I've asked Joe Burns and Q Wong, the VP for Facility Services, to convene a group of faculty and administrators who will need to work on how to get that done. And they've apparently already picked the group.
Potentially, we have something like 10 members, two co-chairs. And looking at that, the discussion earlier today, that maybe we should have one more person who basically is right there.
So we're going to be off and running, and we hope to get this done. That is, I hope to get the wisdom of the group back by basically the end of the semester, by June 1, so that we can begin to move on this. To remind you where we are on getting to carbon neutrality, we're about a third of the way of where we wanted to go, and most of that distance has been achieved by big jumps based on capital expenditures. So the campus gains a lot in reduction of energy used by the lake source cooling. That was a project that was done, you know, a long time ago before my time here, and it was expensive. It was a very good investment. The combined heat and power plant is an roughly $80 million investment. It was a beautiful example of the, with respect to my faculty colleagues, of the non-faculty professionals and the staff coming up with a great idea about how to allow one plant to do both heat and power. It allowed us to go coal-free, one of the first campuses in the country to go coal-free. The Sierra Club came out and celebrated it with us. and it took us another quantum, if you will, toward carbon neutrality. The third piece was deciding that we would spend tens of millions of dollars over time taking the buildings on campus that are aged and aging buildings and making them more energy efficient so that the actual use of energy would be reduced. We allocated $46 million for that. We've spent over 40 so far. That's a small fraction of the overall deferred maintenance on campus, but it's a big step in the right direction. And the decision was made during the recession. So I'm proud of Vice President Q Wong and others who pushed those expenditures. Now, to get to carbon neutrality, whether it's 2035 or some other time, I believe, and I should have prefaced this by saying I am not an expert in either plank of the resolution, not in investments and not in geoscience. But I've done a lot of reading, probably not as much as some colleagues, but I've done a lot of reading. And I believe that three things will be necessary for us to come to carbon neutrality. One will be more capital expenditures. That'll have two pieces to it. One is finding the projects to do that will actually move the needle toward carbon neutrality, like going coal-free. The second is some new technologies are going to have to be developed. I'm convinced that we don't have the technologies nor the personal will to reduce our consumption enough to get to carbon neutrality without different technologies. And so I've urged in the resolution that the faculty consider reorienting some of their efforts in teaching and research toward climate change. And I was quick to add in my response to the resolution that it's not my place to tell faculty what to do in the classroom or the research lab, but nonetheless, I was exhorting them, if they've taken it seriously, to think about orienting themselves more toward this. And over 300 faculty have voluntarily become faculty fellows in the Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, which I think is a priori evidence that people do take it seriously, and maybe we could do more. And the third piece of it is we all have to change our habits. We have to turn the lights off in the buildings when we're not using them. We have to turn the thermostats down in the winter and up in the summer. We have to change our transportation habits, and those are hard things to do. I live 1.5 miles from here. I drive a car every day to get both directions. And so everybody from me to you is going to have to change our habits in order to consume less energy. And this is a campus that is an energy-hungry campus because we have science buildings, buildings that run all night long, 24/7, doing experiments, using equipment that's energy absorbing, high frequency equipment, refrigerators down to -80, all kinds of things. So I accepted that. Those are the three things I thought we had to do, and I've assigned a committee through Joe Burns and Q Wong's offices to go ahead and do that, and I hope we can succeed. I fully intend for us to succeed. Maybe we can do it even faster in 2035. Depends on our aggregate activity. On the divestment half, I have heard enormously from the campus about this. I want to say publicly that the reason I haven't yet met with your group separate is that I want to meet with the Faculty Senate first, who sent me the resolution. I know you disagree with that, but that's what I want to do. I met with the UFC yesterday, the Faculty Senate Executive Committee, and they agreed with my point of view to meet with the Senate. I've also gotten people who I also respect who have the opposite point of view about you on this. I'm not an expert in investment. I've looked carefully at the very cogent argument that David and his colleagues have sent. I've looked carefully at cogent arguments that people who are investment professionals have sent. And I don't know, and I want to be plain about this, I don't know for sure whether divestment will hurt our endowment or not. I want to be clear about that. So you might say, well, why not do it if you're not sure? Aren't we comparing a moral imperative with a financial imperative? And here's why I'm not willing to recommend it to the investment committee. And I want to make sure that you understand the way the university works. Accelerating the pace of carbon neutrality is in my power to do, and I've done it. The divestment is not in my power except to recommend to the investment committee. Not even the full board of trustees votes on investments, just the investment committee. And I've sent them my recommendation not to divest, and here's why. The university budget is $3.6 billion. $2.1 billion of that is on the Ithaca campus. The $2.1 billion Ithaca expenditures, $2.1 billion, our projection, my projection for the year we're in now, is that on June 30 of this year, when the fiscal year ends, we'll have a margin of $3 million on a budget of $2.1 billion, so barely breaking even. And I'm not willing to put the campus at risk of going into deficit in case those who say that it won't hurt us are wrong. Now, maybe a year or two will go by, and maybe the precarious positive balance of the university's budget will be more robust, and I'll think that, you know, it's worth the risk. I don't think it's worth the risk right now, and here's why not. The way we balanced the budget after having a $148 million projected deficit the first year of the recession was we froze everybody's salary for a year, we stopped borrowing money, we stopped building for a while, we reduced the staff workforce from its high water mark by 9%. You will not find, to my knowledge, another university like ours that reduced the staff workforce by that amount. When people ask me, what mistakes have I made being president of two universities? One that I'm quick to talk about is that maybe I overdid it in the amount of reduction of the staff workforce. Many of my staff colleagues have told me that. Many of my faculty colleagues have told me that. I don't believe there's any room to further thin out the staff ranks. We've also continued to raise tuition in a super inflationary way. I don't think there's any room to be even more aggressive with tuition. And since the number of people working here and getting salaries and the tuition that the students pay are the two major elements that would help balance the budget, I'm not willing to put us at risk about that. Please understand, you are more than free. You have the mandate to go over my head on this and go to the investment committee or the board of trustees. I will not be offended or upset or anything like that. At the end of the day, after thinking about this a lot, I have to live with myself that I'm being what I consider to be a prudent steward of the university's resources, and we barely have a balanced budget, and there's a lot of people's livelihoods at stake here, as well as a lot of students' tuition payments. So that's where I'm at. I accepted the first plank. I put it into motion. I rejected the second plank, not because I don't think it's a moral imperative. I've shown that I believe in that the endowment can be used at times for other purposes, by suggesting a Darfur divestment, but this is a much different scale, and I don't believe that I can tell you for sure, I don't believe I can tell you or your constituents, look you in the eye, and tell you for sure that it's safe to divest in terms of the what we depend on the endowment for. Those are the facts, and I'm glad to have you discuss it with me. I'm glad to have you ignore me and vote it anyway. I'm glad to have you go over my head. That's my feeling on this, not based on being stubborn, honest to God, just based on the fact that I go to bed at night and I think about the livelihoods and the students' tuition, and that's where we're at. So I'm glad to talk about it now, and I'm glad to talk to you about it in the morning, too, so it won't give you indigestion while we're eating.
Questions?
Federal government was so restrictive on this.
Well, you know, honestly, I think that governments in general do not have this organized kind of shared governance. They have, one elected body, but we have the advantage of having many different points of view, and they don't always line up. That's the beauty of the shared governance. But the UA represents everybody, and so we should keep talking about this. And the moral imperative to do something about climate change is not going to go away. It's probably going to get worse because of emerging economies and because of the fact that America is still a big energy user. So there's no question that the goal is unbelievably important for us to keep our shoulder to the wheel on. The question at the end of the day is, decisions I make that affect people's lives on campus. So I wish it was easier. It's a tough one. I've had a tough time struggling with it. And one thing I do appreciate, by the way, that I want to say publicly is that Joe, as dean of faculty, has come to, if not all, virtually all of my senior staff meetings since he was elected, something I know is probably aggravating to him because it eats up that pesky free time he's been wondering about. I think what he means is we can talk about whether that's time well spent, but that's a different story.
questions? Mr. LaSalle, you had a question earlier in Startups New York?
The PDF got passed out in January, the brochure where that was going to set some framework for Startup New York. Where does that stand?
Yeah, it's... Yeah, so thanks for asking that. For those of you who don't know, just to be sure, forgive me if you do, Startup New York is a program that the state of New York established in which new companies or expansion of existing companies, but not existing companies, under certain rules and procedures can set up shop related to a university, especially in the upstate area, and receive very, very substantial tax abatements, including not only property tax abatements to some extent, but also going all the way to corporate taxes and to individual state income taxes being abated for years based on the criteria. So the state of New York and the SUNY system organized this. Every campus had to have a designee who would be our representative to Startup New York. Ours is Vice President Mary Opperman. Vice President Opperman, you know largely as an HR professional who's also in charge of the CUPD, Environmental Health and Safety, and her title is VP for Human Resources and Safety Services. She's also a very, very active community participant, has chaired boards of nonprofits in the community, has served on the Tompkins County Area Development Board as my designee, and so on. And I've asked her to take up new duties doing some community-based economic development work. She and her colleagues were the ones that put in the proposal that got us the capital money to build the Downtown Incubator. Downtown Incubator is being done as a partnership between among us and TC3 and Ithaca College. We purposely put it downtown, so it's on the tax rolls. It's not on our property. And we got, thanks to Mary and her colleagues' good work, we got $1 million capital fund from the state in a very austere climate to build out more room for more companies that'll be open to anybody, whether they have something to do with Cornell TC3 and IC or not, students, faculty, regular, ordinary human beings, whatever. As long as they have a good idea and they can get in there, they can do that. And some other things have also occurred. So where we are right now is we've submitted basically the material you saw in the draft form, give or take, with indications of what sites would be available. And I'm sorry to be caught flat-footed. I can't tell you exactly where we are in the process of getting feedback from the state, but... Jim, if you'd be comfortable, you could query Mary Opperman directly so you get the correct answer, the real answer, and just say that I asked you to check in on behalf of the UA about exactly where we're at with the Startup New York process. But we're, you know, she's met all the deadlines and met all the, jumped through all the hoops to get us to be participants. And now the companies need to come forward and, you know, be interested in utilizing these tax abatements and setting up here and hopefully staying here and adding jobs to the community. One more thing, I'm sorry. One more thing I forgot to mention, forgive me. She and her colleagues, Mary and her colleagues, also came up with a very interesting concept that won another statewide competition. The state said they would identify 5 regions as innovation hotspots. And what they did was come up with one for the whole southern tier that includes Binghamton University on one side, Corning Painted Post, that area on the other side, and Ithaca in the middle, where Ithaca is sort of the center, the hub of this large regional hotspot. And we put an application, and we won one of the 5 hotspot designations. And so we have some money to help operate the incubator. We have a designation in terms of, you know, sort of advertising, marketing potential as a hotspot. And the idea would be that we would bring some more jobs, not just to the Tompkins County area, but to the whole southern tier, which is an area of very, very substantial economic challenge. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, I was only slightly confused in that I knew that our Startup New York's or Startups New York package had gone in.
Right.
But it sounds like now we're waiting for people to apply. Has it been awarded or granted, or is acceptance?
You have to ask
okay.
Mary. My understanding is that we're eligible and that we're going through the process of connecting with the companies and doing all the administrative things. This program, the companies will have to qualify, you know, for the tax abatements as well as the university qualifying. And so, I'm sorry, I can't give you a more discreet, but Mary can tell you chapter and verse.
I might add a little bit. My recollection is that the state gets to hold this for 1 month to 2 month duration, and during that period, there's a review and
make sure
they prove. And we're in the midst of that.
Okay. I bet that's correct.
March or something like that.
I bet that's correct.
And if I could just add to the idea that something was posted and that it hasn't changed, right now we're going through an RFP process where we're going to be building out websites. So Mary Scoop is overseeing that. Tom Shriver is in charge of it. And we're going to be building a presence for the hotspot, the incubator, and for Startup New York. So that will evolve. But while we're in the commenting period, it's fairly static in terms of the information that's posted and available.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
And Mary can give you a little bit more, I'm sure.
Thank you. Other questions? How many medals did Cornelians win?
Was since you are rooting for Canada or not?
Sure, if they're Cornelian. Anything else for President Scorton? Well, then, thank you, sir, for coming
great.
Once again and sharing your time with us. And
yeah,
your
no, it's a pleasure, and so we'll see each other at breakfast, I guess.
Sure. It's a good one.
Yeah, thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you for coming.
Yep.
And now I'd like to return to the previous presenter, Mary Beth Grant, to finish her presentation on the Judicial Administrator's Office. All right, come to order. We still have a few more things we need to cover, regrettably.
One of the reasons, among many, that we added them in during the time that you all were, or if you were here, that your predecessors were talking about the disadvantages of 6.4, one of the concerns was that there were too few people involved in the process. So looking like a single person making an investigative report, a single person making a review, that would be then appealed to a single person. So we tried to increase the eyes and ears and the brain working on these issues. So this is one of the ways that we're trying to do it. Can't promise it's going to continue. It's the reason I didn't suggest this to be actually in the policy is because it's a huge amount of resources. And, you know, the folks who've been volunteering to do this have been very generous with their time. Who knows how their supervisors can be feeling at the end of the year. So we'll do it for this year and then see what happens after that. The second advantage is the comfort of the parties. This is something that we've all been feeling. Compared to a system where the parties might wind up before a hearing board telling their story to a bunch of strangers, being confronted in an aggressive, dramatic, sometimes bullying way by opposing counsel, having to be face-to-face with either a complainant who might be trying to stare down a respondent or a respondent who engaged in horrific behavior, all of those things add the stress for both of the parties involved. Rather than that, there's a small meeting room with either Jody or Clint and one other person from our office, as I've already described, the individual and his or her advisor.
much more comfortable that, you know, talk about it over a glass of water or a cup of coffee. And, you know, still challenging questions, still hard to talk about these issues, but takes away some of the external factors that could prevent people from going forward or from feeling comfortable as they present themselves. Related to that is the decrease of drama. I saw Brian Chabot over there, who has sat as a hearing board chair in many cases where there could be people from the outside being the representative for a case person, for example, that use the same kind of tactics that they might use in the criminal justice system for discrimination, and you know, sort of being up here instead of let's just talk, let's just try and figure out what happened. And just in general, the type of ways that a criminal justice model operates is more dramatic in general, instead of let's have a conversation, let's ask tough questions, but let's just figure out what happened. Something that I hadn't thought about until I've been seeing some of the decisions and the ways that folks have approached it is that there's some time for the decision makers, the review panel, the three-person review panelists who will be the ultimate decision makers. There's time for them to think about things. So they receive the report from our office. Our report makes findings of fact and recommendations, either dismiss the case if there is not enough evidence or make the recommendation to find the person responsible with appropriate sanctions. And the reviewers have the opportunity to meet over a period of time. There are a 10-day period where the parties can write in and say, we disagree with this part of the report, or we agree with this part of the report. So the reviewers have 2 weeks, essentially, to read it, think about where their questions are. They have the ability to meet a number of times. There's no time limit on how quickly they need to finish their review. They can come back to the investigators to ask more questions. They can ask the investigators to reopen the investigation. Compared to the hearing board process that's all done often in one night, but sometimes in the course of a couple of nights. But, you know, the hearing boards can go late sometimes. Decisions are being made quickly. There might not be the opportunity to sleep on it and think things through. We've had hearing boards go till 4 in the morning. People are making decisions, you know, at a time when they're maybe not quite so fresh. So that's, I think, something really positive that we hadn't considered. This would be part of the problem. So are there questions? Sure, there always are. We're in the growing pains thing. But I just have to give a shout out to Joe Burns. I'm looking through this list that I prepared, you know, last week, and Joe's already addressed several of them. So I'm very grateful for your work, Joe. But also go through them so you know what we're working through. The three-person faculty panel, you know, that was added after doing the community forum as a way to involve more people, more brains on the issue. But it's also a challenge because we have a group of faculty members who are volunteering their time. We initially thought that there would maybe only be 3 cases a year that would go to the faculty panel, but because we removed the ability to do an informal resolution, many cases are going to the panel. And that's hard. You know, it's hard on the folks who are doing the review work. It's hard on Joe and his staff to gather those people together. Joe was able to identify 6 more folks who were doing training next week, or a couple of trainings actually, to get that trained. So hopefully that will reduce some of that challenge. But I suspect that something will be coming back at the end of the year, after this first year, to review about whether we should continue with that or not, because it is administratively, from a human resource perspective, a challenge. So I covered this more than we were talking about. Having enough volunteers can be a problem. Providing sufficient training for panels can also be a problem. So I'm doing a training that's about a 3-hour-long training. But for those of you who are familiar with the area of sexual assault, it takes years to really understand the very challenging in nuance, nothing. So one of the things that I think Joe is also trying to do is to have a mix on the panel of people who maybe have those years and years of experience already mixed in with folks who may be less experienced. But it's clear that a three-hour training by me is not, you know, and I say by me, it's also, you know, people from Gannett and some other experts that I've organized and put forward. That 3 hours alone is not going to give people enough depth of information. And I would venture to say that any one-day training is not going to replace the things that people learn over the course of a lifetime. So, you know, that will be something that we'll continue to grapple with. The getting panels timely was something that I was struggling with. I was reading that, and I thought that doesn't really capture what the issue was. I was trying to struggle with what's the appropriate timing for asking for the panel to make sure that we don't have people sort of hanging and waiting for the investigative report, and the investigation is still going on, and it could take, you know, 2 months for the investigation versus waiting too long and then, you know, needing the panel really quickly. So that's something that we're, you know, trying to figure out the perfect balance there. And something that Joe has already worked on is to having the co-ed panels. We got feedback from the chairs of a couple of the panels that when they were all men, that they felt like it wasn't providing enough balance. So that should be resolved by the end of next week. Because we've got more women in training. But as you're talking to your colleagues, I'm looking right now at the faculty members, and if you know folks who might be interested in this kind of work and being more involved in volunteering, please get in touch with Joe so that I'll continue doing training, you know, throughout the year so that we can have a good pool of people, and hopefully folks will carry over, will do an evaluation with people to find out where we have work to do and keep it an ongoing process. Another challenge is just timing. So the government made it really clear that the investigation should take no more than 60 days. 60 days goes really fast, especially when you consider winter break, summer vacations, the number of students. Joe is working on a case where you should be already 17 witnesses. So, and fitting it in among all of the work that that you're working on, like the bags under her eyes. You know, but the 60 days can go really fast, and there's some flexibility in that, but that can be a challenge. Writing the report takes a lot longer than we thought. So when you go back to the first page, that formal complaint, between 3 and 11 prior to this year, only 3, maybe 4 of those cases went to a hearing. So even if all of them wound up finding a violation, that would be resolved in an informal agreement, one of the summary decision agreements, which takes about half an hour to write. We're now writing these detailed investigative reports that are, you know, like 10 pages long and are very nuanced. You want to get the language right. You want to make sure that you're describing things correctly. It takes hours and hours and days, and so that's something that we hadn't anticipated. So, it's as if every case is going to hearing and requiring that level of preparation. It takes more time. And so that's from the data.
Who go to
the
fourth
book? They go to the review panel. The panel really faculty members will review it. So I should have reviewed this, Randy. I'll just make sure that folks are aware that the process is investigation by our office, review, that's by 3 faculty members, appeal, and that's the decision. And then also balancing for the folks who choose to go to the criminal justice system, balancing the timing with our system. KZ referenced a case that happened, or the allegations were from April of 2013, and just now, 10 months later, there's the indictment. Who knows when the trial will happen. So in a case like that, it's typical for a respondent, an accused person, to not want to speak to investigators because I don't want information that they provide in our system to come out in the criminal justice system. They can subpoena our records. And the prosecutors aren't thrilled about us providing opportunities for the defense to learn about the complainant's position of what happened and perspective about what happened. So it's a balancing act. It's a very, very clear from case law, from the regulations from the government, from our own policy, that we cannot wait for the criminal justice system to be completed, and that creates challenges. So we're going to go forward with them and try to be as careful as we can, but ultimately we need to make sure that we're following our practices and our policies. Another challenge just comes from the expectations of advisors for respondents. So you recall, a lot of the advisors for respondents are used to mandatory hearings, particularly those who practice the criminal law, so they're all fired up for that. The games isn't quite the right word, but some of the strategies and things that are used in an adversarial system, sort of ready for an argument in a fight. And in Discover Arizona, that in particular, the concept that the prosecutor has to turn over their whole file to a defense attorney. And they're not really used to the concept that the JA's office is being a neutral investigator. We don't have a horse in this race, we just want to figure out what happened. I think that that's the way we're already operating under the code, because we've just missed plenty of cases that we weren't, that we didn't think there was sufficient evidence to prove. But even more with this investigative type of model, we're really emphasizing that, and there's going to be a lag time until they people from the outside world in particular catch up and understand that. Identifying an advisor for complainants has been another challenge. So recall that a big underlying premise of the change is to make sure that there's equity between the parties, that anything that we provide for a respondent is also available for a complainant. Similar appeal rights, the ability to have people representing them, things like that. So right now, the complainant can bring anyone he or she wants to a meeting, for example, but the judicial code counselors who are second and third year law students are available to help respondents with their legal needs. So, for example, we had a student who wrote into the panel recently, and as I was reading it, I thought, this sophomores do not write this. Second year law student wrote it, which is fine. That's not a problem. That's perfectly permissible within our system. But there might be a situation where a complainant would like similar types of help. So we've been having trouble identifying who could be that advisor for the complainant. President Thornton has given us permission to identify the person who's having it. And we're looking for somebody who's a permanent staff member or faculty member so that we don't have to change over any training issues. Something that I forgot to put on here is letter D would be the surprises. The biggest surprise that we've had as we've been investigating cases and handling these complaints is that there are a number of cases that fit both within the code as well as policy 6.4. We knew that that would happen sometimes, but it really didn't happen that much. So one example was a student who was accused of strangling another student, and when Jody was doing the investigation and was interviewing the complainant, she said, well, all of this is in the context of sexual harassment, and there were a bunch of emails and prior contacts that were of a sexually harassing nature. Another example was somebody who was beating someone up at the same time he was threatening that individual with sexual assault from different kinds of things that he was going to do to him. So there's a lot of situations where we're finding, we need to make a choice, which process do we go through? And I think that will be something we continue to work on. So that's all the information I wanted to present about the change to 6.4.
Does anybody have any thoughts or questions about that before I go on to the next topic?
I guess the only thing that I would ask is just part of the staff needs to be done, but
it might wind up being a staff issue.
And the thing that you warned us about dealing with this, but you kind of think that as I recall, the data suggests that the number of referrals is probably only a fraction of the outcome.
That's right.
So is there anyone in your office that's actually working on, I mean, if this is great that we see this dramatic increase in the referrals, and let's say that it's only one quarter of the total.
Yes.
I mean, is it possible that we've actually come up with some sort of plan or scheme that allows us to dramatically increase the number of referrals? Unfortunately, there's an issue with the
working. But that's what we want.
That's what you want.
Yeah.
Because you have a staff that can do
it. We don't. No, we absolutely don't. They have a game plan, you know, should there be an increase beyond what we are able to control about it. I have people identified in the community who will be able to work on a per diem basis.
I was actually going to ask, are there any examples of best practices on other campuses? We've seen increases, where the increases have even been more dramatic than the LSU students, and is it possible to implement those best practices that are actually the best?
You know, it's a really good question. When the first conference I went to, an Ivy Plus conference, which was in June of 2012, so about a year after the Dear Colleague letter and a lot of these changes started being implemented nationwide, the colleagues around the table were all reporting big jumps in their numbers, and one institution reported 50 cases that year, and I said, whoa, right, your seatbelt, right? And we hadn't seen that, but I do predict that the numbers will continue to go up, and I'm not aware of exactly how other institutions have dealt with it. The one thing that I've heard a lot of people trying to experiment with is having one dedicated person who does all sexual assault investigations, and
I apologize to interrupt. Our meeting time is coming to a close. Can I have a motion to extend the meeting for 10 minutes? Do I have a second? All in favor? All right. Please continue.
Sure. There are pros and cons to it. One of the reasons that we didn't develop that practice is that we wanted to increase the number of people with the expertise. Probably since about 2008 when our numbers first started going up, I was handling all of the sexual assault investigations it's also when we had staffing changes, and Jody and at the time Scott Grant were both new to the office, and probably I was low control. Booker's known me for a long time. But it doesn't make sense for that expertise to be in just one person. You know, it makes sense for a lot of reasons. I might win the lottery someday, and if I'm gone, somebody needs to be able to carry on the work. So there's a lot of good reasons to keep it more similarly, some of the investigators who work with HR in Alan Mitten's office, we're thinking that they might at some point be lead investigators and figure that out. So we are anticipating an increase. The more we talk about it, the more it appears in the sun, the more people appreciate some of the differences with respect to being supported and the increased drama and increased comfort, the more we expect people to come forward. We don't necessarily expect a dramatic change in how many cases will be found, people will be found responsible or not, because they're still hard cases. But I think the key thing is to make sure that people are coming forward so that they can
support. Sure. And for the sake of time, do you have some final wrap-up thoughts for us?
Yeah. The only other thing I wanted to just let you all know is that changing the emphasis of the work of the GAA, I mean, me personally as opposed to the office. So as an office, we're still doing the same work in terms of handling a lot of cases and doing a lot of things. What's changed for me personally is that I'm handling far fewer cases and working more on strategic planning efforts, policy efforts, and things like that. So that's something that could have implications if folks are trying to reach me. They might have a little bit more trouble reaching me. They might, I know that
our campus police colleagues are often, you know, funneled to Jody or Clint, whoever is handling the case. We've got support from residential programs where we have somebody from that office who routinely works with our office to help with some of the extra load. So that's something that a way that we're trying to make sure that we're handling a broader array of issues, being more involved in a broader long-term plan.
Thank you very much. Are there any high-level questions for Mary Beth Grant? Well, thank you very much for your presentation. I appreciate it. And you too, Chief Zoner, thank you for your keeping us informed in, as to what both of your offices are doing. It's a very important part of campus governance. Moving on briefly, we only have a few minutes left for new business, and then we'll come back to the committees. So you heard President Scorton's remarks on carbon footprint and divestment. So the discussion that or guidance I need from you is, does this assembly wish to tee up this issue? We have been asked by Professor Shabbat to sign on to the Faculty Senate's resolution that they pass. Okay? There's a lot of discussions. There's pros and cons. We would need to invite expertise here. I think Professor Shabbat would certainly be willing to present if he's available. But there's people we'd want to talk to on the investment side and perhaps the counter opinions. We know that the President supports carbon neutrality in 2035. That's half. We know he does not support divestment. That's not a reason not to delve into it. But I need your direction. Do you want to take up this issue, or do you want to let it sit? If you want to take it up, I will schedule it for March 11th, and we will take it up to determine whether you want to sponsor this resolution, whether you want to break it in two and sponsor half of it, or none of the above, because the work's been done and it would be a matter of registering opinions. Your thoughts? Randomly. Randy?
Take it up.
Take it up. Others?
I actually have a thought about this. Is, I guess, based on talking to some of the GCSA reps sort of offline, they mentioned sort of having slightly different opinions for the carbon neutrality versus divestment. I was curious what you guys thought about perhaps splitting these up into two separate issues and sort of discussing the merits of them separately, because I think, at least in the GPSA, there were definitely people who were all for moving up the deadline, but they were less, I guess, educated about the topic of divestment. And so, you know, they sort of aren't quite, I guess, like President Swart mentioned, there are two planks of that resolution, but we could split it up, and I think actually that might be more valuable to get our opinion on.
I don't think splitting it up would be a good use of time, because the President has already said that he approves of the moving up the time frame for carbon neutrality. So unless we wanted to move it up even further, unless we were going to address something significantly different from what's already passed, I think the real issue is whether or not we want to take up the divestment issue specifically. So splitting it up would be a good idea if there was more defense over the issues, I think.
Is the March 11th a realistic? I mean, are we able to get, one, the information we need to make an informed, educated decision?
We would not.
Is there enough realistic time on the agenda based on what's already on the agenda? I mean, and is there other work that we should be doing? Unless a member from the floor wants to introduce something, you know what I mean? Like,
so right now we have anywhere from 3 to 5 resolutions that we will, one, that we hope to vote on and put to bed. We will be addressing at March 11th the TCAT issue, an outbrief from the Campus Infrastructure Committee on their recommendations on how to balance the books on TCAT. Those two are must-do. Then we have some other things that I believe are coming forward that I don't mean to belittle the importance, because they're very important, but they have less time sensitivity to them. Can we take this up on the 11th? Absolutely. We would not be, well, it would be up to you, but unless there's a sense of the body resolution, we would not be voting on any resolution. We would be coming to, you know, splitting up, what are the facts, what do we support, and after that meeting, we would be drafting a resolution that would meet the March 25th meeting and determining whether we want to dispose of it at that meeting, the following meeting, and such. You know, that would be the timeline, and yes, it's the end of term, and yes, it would be a rushed event. So if we're going to do something startlingly new, time is very much against us. I think there's a lot of research and the facts that we have readily available to us to pull on. So if it's a matter of supporting or perhaps saying, no, we don't agree with certain things, I think that that is potentially doable. I would want to give you both sides. I'd want to have a real pro person up here, and I'd want to have somebody goes, I can't disagree enough with what I just heard, and present the other side of the story, and then you can determine whether you have enough facts or not. This is clearly not easy. Part of it is symbolic. Part of it is got different impacts, and we let those folks speak for themselves. So I hear the equivalent of a motion from the floor to you want to hear more. Is there the equivalent of a de facto second to that? Yes, Rosemary?
I'd like to hear some more.
Very good. Then I will tee it up for March 11th, and we'll decide then whether we're going to move forward with it. But I'll get you the basic facts and be in contact, requesting more formally your involvement, and we'll tee it up. So I have guidance on that. Now coming back to the reports, Campus Infrastructure Committee, you got about 30 seconds.
Everyone knows the TCAT issue is deficit. We drafted it up. Where we come up with some ideas as to how to address that, and general consensus was that the free override passes was the large aspect was causing deficit. So the conclusion drawn was that we have to eliminate that, or at least that's the resolution. The first year.
More details on March 11th, where you'll be able to take it up, debate, and find out how fine their thinking is. And they have really, really looked into this. Campus welfare, Mr. Moore.
We have a resolution regarding campus climate that has been forwarded on to the executive committee and shall be introduced soon.
Mr. Measy.
So Mary Beth and her office is going to be looking through 6.4 to see if there's any changes that are required by the code. I know she's put that towards the...
Way around the code.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's what I... Yeah. Just making sure the two documents align. We're also... I think, reached an agreement with counsel's office on the rights of the summary... appeal the summary decision agreement by the complainant. So we'll be hearing those and then bringing those back to the...
Will you be making March 11th?
Our next meeting is the 4th, or whatever that Friday is, I think, our next CJC meeting.
So the 11th is in 2 weeks.
It's the 6th.
Yes.
Our goal is to have them by the 11th.
Make that a very high goal, because to meet advertising, and if we decide to do something meaningful and get public comment, we turn into pumpkins essentially at the end of April, which means if I don't have it teed up and ready to truly discuss by March 25th, we're not going to be able to do anything meaningful other than pass a sounds good, and we hope they take it back up next session. Is there any other business before the assembly? If not, a motion to adjourn. And by unanimous consent, the motion is adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.